In May 2019, the husband and wife, Alva and Alberta Pilioit, won a federal court case against Monsanto. According to the website Top Tens, the world's most evil company. The husband and wife had developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This cancer causes white blood cells called lymphocytes to grow abnormally throughout the body. The farmers worked decades with the herbicide, which the company Monsanto claimed is safe to use. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer categorized the active ingredient in Roundup, glyphosate, as a probable carcinogen, and this was the basis for the judge's decision to decide in favor of the couple. The company Bayer had to pay a fine of $2 billion because it had acquired Monsanto, the manufacturer of Roundup. 1 year after the merger, Bayer's share price was still cut in half. The pharmaceutical giant had signed up for an ever-increasing avalanche of legal battles. In 2019, 18,000 lawsuits were pending in the US, most of them due to cancer cases potentially linked to Roundup. For numerous decades, Monsanto had marketed their herbicide as safe to use for farmers and individuals. And most regulatory bodies categorize glyphosate as safe. So why does the International Agency for Research on Cancer come to a different conclusion than all the other agencies? Possibly because they only consider, I quote, publicly available and pertinent studies by independent experts free from vested interests. But apparently, the amount of independent studies on glyphosate-based herbicides is rather limited. How can the world's most used pesticide have so few independent studies? Is this really a coincidence? Let's first take a look at the history of Monsanto. We will cover the benefits and downsides of Roundup, look at the pesticide study by the French researcher Seralini, and investigate how Monsanto used various tactics to take down the study and the researcher. It is a fascinating and highly insightful story, showing us about how corporates may influence what science is published and what science is taken down. What you're about to hear is made up of my own research, so we are not talking about a book, and it yet fits right in with the last episode we had already on Roundup. You will find the transcript of the episode with all the sources linked in the show notes. A special thanks to the Adalbert Rapps Foundation funding food science research for a sustainable food system. More on them in a bit. Let's jump right in. Red to Green is the most in-depth podcast on food sustainability. And in this season 7, we discuss key takeaways from books on the food system. I'm your host, Marina Schmidt, and I'm joined by my co-host, Frank Kühne.
Today is a special episode. The podcast and article represent the personal opinions and interpretations of the participants. The statements may be exaggerated for entertainment and/or comedic purposes. Every effort has been made to ensure the accuracy and reliability of the information presented per the cited sources on the website. However, the participants do not guarantee the completeness or timeliness of the information. Readers are encouraged to verify the information presented and conduct their own research independently. The participants acknowledge that Bayer, Crop Science and/or other parties involved have the right to alternative interpretations of matters discussed. Thank you. Monsanto started out rather innocently in 1901. It was producing the sugar substitute saccharide and caffeine for one of its biggest and long-term customers, Coca-Cola. The founder, John Francis Queeny, felt America should reduce its dependence on German chemical giants like Bayer. This just adds a bit of irony to the merger of Monsanto and Bayer. I think John Francis Queeny would have not been happy about that. In 1944, Monsanto started producing DDT. The synthetic insecticide was used to combat malaria, typhus, and other insect-induced diseases. And here's just a little side note. So pesticides are like an overarching term. They include insecticides used to kill insects, herbicides used to kill weeds, and fungicides
used to destroy fungi. For the insecticide DDT, Monsanto did not conduct thorough toxicological studies and also didn't own a toxicology lab. Yet it claimed DDT would be safe to use, a pattern that would repeat throughout company history. In the 1940s, before it was banned, DDT was generously sprayed on streets. In 1965, the company produced Agent Orange for the US military. This herbicide was sprayed during the Vietnam War to uncover hidden troops and destroy local food production. Agent Orange destroys all kinds of vegetation across the board. In some aspects, similar to Roundup, it's really an all-in-one solution. After the war had ended, the US banned the use of DDT and Agent Orange. Both turned out to be toxic to wildlife and humans, as well as being probable carcinogens. However, at that time, the company was already working on the herbicide Roundup. The main ingredient, glyphosate, was, I quote, "the once in a corporate lifetime discovery, possibly as revolutionary as penicillin," end quote. Within two decades, glyphosate became the world's most used herbicide. Due to patents, Monsanto was the only producer until the turn of the century. Monsanto had a good time with glyphosate, but peak popularity was yet about to come. The company started researching genetically modified seeds in the 80s, just in time before the Roundup patent would run out. It introduced Roundup Ready soybeans in 1996. Beforehand, farmers sprayed Roundup pre- and post-harvest. So imagine you have your soybeans and you want to get rid of those pesky weeds. Roundup kills all plants. So if you spray it on your soybeans, you won't harvest anything. Therefore, you would only spray it before or after seeding the soybeans. But if you plant GM soybeans, they won't die because of Roundup. Roundup would kill any weeds except the resistant crops, leaving you with a very clean field. This all-in-one herbicide solution catapulted Monsanto to the top, also making it the world's biggest supplier of seeds. So let's look at how Roundup and GMO crops are strategically linked. And just as a side note, with this episode, I don't want to talk about whether GM is bad or good. It's really just technology, and it can be used for many various purposes. In this episode, we are only talking about how Monsanto used GM crops. Up until this point in time, Monsanto produced various pesticides, but wasn't known as a seed company. By 2015, these two categories, seed and pesticides, made up 68% of Monsanto's revenue. This package deal enabled Monsanto to raise seed prices from $19 to $55 per kilogram. To be fair, apparently, this also turned out to be pretty handy for farmers. You have one herbicide to rule them all, and you can spray it without worrying about affecting your soy plant. While it would be much easier to focus just on the herbicide without talking about GMOs, it will leave half the topic on the table. Independent studies show that Monsanto's glyphosate-based herbicides on their own weren't performing significantly better than other brands. This highlights the strategic importance of the package deal. According to a study from 2012, approximately 82% of GMOs were herbicide resistant, with Monsanto owning the majority of them. As any press or safety problems associated with Roundup residues directly affect sales of GMO crops and vice versa, this arguably leads to higher stakes for the Monsanto Corporation. This is a very good opportunity to point out the importance of independent research. And independent research needs independent funding. The Adalbert Raps Foundation belongs, as Frank told me, to the German people. And it offers grants for food science research that is focused on sustainability. That can be in alternative proteins, food waste, biotech, all of the topics that we have covered on Red to Green, and anything else beyond that, that can help practically improve our food system. Located in Germany, they do fund a lot of research in Europe, but it is also possible to apply if you're outside of Europe. The foundation can only sponsor universities or research institutions. So if you are a startup founder, you would then work with a research institution on a topic that relates to your business, for example, and benefit from having the insights, but not having to fund the research yourself. Just Google the Adalbert Rapps Foundation or follow the link in the comments to find out more. You can also just directly reach out to Frank by typing Frank Alexander Kühne into LinkedIn. And with that, back to the episode. Now let's look at the blind spots in research. Glyphosate, the main active component in Roundup, destroys an enzyme in plants. This enzyme is EPSPS. It's necessary for synthesizing the building blocks of proteins called amino acids. So Roundup interferes with important metabolic pathways in the plant, and therefore it kills most plants that come into contact with it, supposedly without affecting humans. But if we look at the research and regulatory landscape, there are three main issues, which are actually addressed by Seralini's study that we will discuss in a bit. The first issue we actually covered in the last episode already. While glyphosate is the active ingredient, 50 to 75% of the actual product is made up of inert ingredients, supporting the permeation, so the getting into the plant body and roots. Inert ingredients do not need to be disclosed on the ingredient label because they are considered trade secrets. That makes it really challenging to regulate them. Glyphosate is supposedly one of the least harmful ingredients in Roundup. N-nitroso compounds are supposed to be some of the most powerful carcinogens in the final formulation. The pesticide arsenic and also taloamines are classified as inert and confidential as well, which enables Monsanto to get away with them. In 2020, the National Toxicology Program published a preliminary report confirming that the formulants of Roundup were more genotoxic than the active ingredient. Being genotoxic means being toxic to DNA. So substances that are genotoxic may bind directly to DNA or act indirectly, leading to DNA damage or affecting enzymes involved in DNA replication. So causing mutations, which may or may not lead to cancer or birth defects. That doesn't sound too positive, I must say. Well, over-focusing on the sole ingredient instead of the commercial product is at the heart of the issue and actually something that most of the agencies are doing. For example, even in 2020, the US Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, based its regulatory decision merely on the active ingredient glyphosate. So let's look at the second issue. Most research does not address glyphosate-resistant crops in combination with herbicides. What does that mean? In studies where the herbicide was applied to GM plants, they were usually not analyzed for residues. And if you remember beforehand, we were saying, well, if you spray Roundup on non-GM plants, then you do it before or after harvest. But with GM plants, you can just spray it all over throughout the entire growing season, and you can spray it directly on the plants. So it must be super important to actually look at what are the residues on the plants, because they're likely way higher. Independent research finds that residues are, I quote, at unexpectedly high levels in resistant plants. There's also an analysis that looks at 20 years of studies of herbicide residues. And that one was shocking, I must say. So 4 out of 30 studies, so really very few, actually even looked at the issue of glyphosate residues. And none of these were funded by industry. And then only 1 out of 30 studies has performed an analysis and quantification of glyphosate residues. So actually looked at how much glyphosate is on the plants. Now let's move on to the third big gap in the scientific literature. In an email sent to her colleagues in 2003, the Monsanto executive Donna Farmer wrote, "You cannot say that Roundup is not a carcinogen. We have not done the necessary testing on the formulation to make that statement. The testing on the formulations is not anywhere near the level of the active ingredient." End quote. She repeated the statement in 2018. So Donna Farmer has been in charge of human safety, and she is now also working for Bayer Crop Sciences, right? Because, said, like, a lot of the executives were taken over. How can you, as somebody in charge of safety, just say, well, you know, we invented this thing in 1974, and like 30 years later, we still haven't really done any tests whether it's actually cancer causing. And then 45 years later, we still haven't done that. Studies conducted by Monsanto for the approval of Roundup were too short, with a runtime of a mere 90 days. They used specific rats. They're called spagy dolly rats. I am totally saying this wrong right now. Spagy dolly. They actually sound funny. And these rats usually develop tumors after 220 days. Therefore, if you do a study with a runtime of 90 days, doesn't tell you anything. Which is one of the reasons why the French researcher Seralini decided to prolong the study setup. So, Seralini, actually, it's a French name, so it should sound something like Gilles-Éric Seralini, who has been a professor of molecular biology and toxicology at the University of Caen since 1991. And according to his own account, he won several times in court against industry lobby between 2011 and 2017. The French researcher is arguably the most prominent and active researcher on the toxicity of GM crops. The most important and most well-known study is the one from 2012, and it's known as part of the Seralini affair. It is a remarkable case study on industry influence on science publication and discussion. Seralini conducted the, at the time, most detailed research on the lifelong consumption of GMOs and Roundup. Until then, NK-503, so the genetically engineered corn strain, had been tested for only 90 days. His study addressed all the three previously mentioned blind spots. So it was using the whole commercial product instead of only using glyphosate. It included GM crops that had been treated with Roundup, and it prolonged the study horizon to 2 years instead of just 90 days. Seralini carefully crafted the setup to resemble the original study by Monsanto, voluntarily provided to the EPA. Unfortunately, the original toxicity tests on genetically modified corn and Roundup are confidential and not available to the public nor the scientific community without requesting special permission. But I must say, that is not super weird. That is sort of typical within the industry. Seralini's research setup used 100 male and 100 female rats, using the same type of rats that Monsanto used. They got 10 different diets tested on females and males, containing standard laboratory rat food, but then also different amounts of genetically modified corn treated with Roundup. In addition, the drinking water would also contain various levels of Roundup. A control group was fed a diet with 33% non-GMO corn. The journal Food and Chemical Toxicology published the study in 2012. In female rats, all treated groups died earlier and had 2 to 3-fold increased mortality, often due to kidney malfunctions and tumors. GM maize and Roundup treatments led to a disbalance of hormones and up to 4 times larger tumors in males, also starting earlier than in the control group. The vast majority of Roundup-consuming rats developed tumors, compared to only 30% of the control group. The tumors were also between 30 to 130% larger than in the control. I will spare you a bit of the details here at this very point. The rats fed with a level of GMOs present in the American diet came down with deadly renal, and hepatic diseases, while the control group did not develop chronic conditions. The study used exposure below current regulatory thresholds and requested that the current regulatory status of the GM maize and Roundup would be reevaluated, because individually or in combination, they may increase tumor incidence. At least that was Seralini's hypothesis. He also mentioned that these exact rat types were recommended for chronic toxicology tests by the National Toxicology Program in the US. I have to mention that this was not a carcinogenic study, but Seralini included pictures of lab rats who developed tumors. If you look up his name, that's probably also what you will find. And you will also find it in the document where I have the transcript. These images, of course, went viral, and they were shared in the news, on the internet, everywhere left and right. No wonder Monsanto absolutely freaked out about that. Now, what can go wrong? It actually started already before the study was published. This is really fascinating to me. So the peer review of the study included the Monsanto toxicologist Bill Haydens. The peer review is the evaluation of scientific work by others working in the same field. And it's one of the most important tools to ensure the quality of scientific research published. But here we have an issue, because somebody from Monsanto is peer reviewing a paper criticizing really a core, strategic, absolutely vital part of Monsanto's business model. One of the most interesting things about the history of Monsanto is that there was a release of internal company documents called the Monsanto Papers because of some lawsuits. So the super cool thing about it is that you can actually look up different emails and documents shared within Monsanto that are publicly available now. And that also gives us a lot of indication that these things actually happened. The Monsanto papers indicate that Haydens, the toxicologist from Monsanto, actually shared the confidential manuscript with the team members at Monsanto. Of course, something that shouldn't happen, right? Arguably, that provided Monsanto with a head start for its PR campaign to discredit the study. Even before the paper was published, Seralini and his team experienced a backlash. The research and the research team were targeted by an industry-driven media and lobbying campaign. I'm going to tell you six ways in which Seralini was affected, possibly by activities initiated from Monsanto. Number one, together with his Monsanto team, Bill Haydens submitted a detailed rebuttal of the paper. So they had like a whole team set together and created this massive file trying to take apart the study of Seralini. And it didn't work. It was unsuccessful. However, it did slow down the publication process. Number two, after the publication, industry leaders were immediately speaking out against Seralini with something called ad hominem arguments. So that means these are arguments which are all about the person instead of the actual work. For example, criticizing his integrity as a person or his professionality just in general without actually pointing to evidence. Number three, his Wikipedia page was, I quote, grossly falsified, quoting blogs instead of his scientific sources. Number four, many of the letters to the editor demanding a takedown of the study were orchestrated by Monsanto itself. Number five, mental and psychological attacks. So while attending official governmental committees, representatives whispered threats like, "Your career is over," to Seralini, according to his own account. Also, he and his family were physically threatened. Number six, this last one really sounds like an abstruse movie. And it's according to his book. He mentions that he was at a speaking gig in London. And for whatever reason, instead of going by cab, he was ushered by other attendees of the conference to rather take the subway. And in the subway, Seralini's leg was really harshly bumped by a suitcase. The spot developed a serious infection that threatened to take his life within 24 hours due to an antibiotic-resistant streptococcus. And apparently, no other cases of this infection were apparent in London. Seralini could only walk again after 5 months, and a year later, he still suffered from the effects. When he researched antibiotic-resistant human streptococcus, the top study was by the Monsanto company, with contributions from R.E. Goodman, the now international editor-in-chief for biology at the magazine where Seralini's study was published. You will see why this is important in a sec. As Seralini declared, I quote, "The link to my condition may have been tenuous, but it was such an unusual coincidence." Okay. That's so wild. This is so, so wild. Other strategies mentioned by Seralini include ghostwriting research papers and operating objective-looking science websites, sponsoring and infiltrating pseudo-conferences, and ruining his reputation to an extent that students would not want to be associated with him. Monsanto dedicated significant sums of money to accomplish the objective. For example, there are also cases in which Monsanto paid researchers like John Aquavella from Denmark $20,000 on top of their salary to produce favorable study results. And in 2015, it invested $17 million in discrediting the IARC, the institution that classified glyphosate as a carcinogen. Maybe you remember in the beginning we talked about the International Agency for Research on Cancer, and the agency certainly had a good amount of backlash for making this claim that glyphosate is an actual carcinogen. Interestingly, various agencies like the EFSA in Europe were criticizing Seralini's studies, and they were criticizing the choice of the rat strain, the study setup, and its documentation. There is a review by two German scientists which highlights the double standards of the EFSA, arguing that Monsanto's study was seen as totally fine. Somehow the EFSA was being particularly hard with Seralini, and the researchers argue, I quote, that EFSA's criteria are not standard practice in 21 other rat feeding studies, end quote. 2 months after the publication of the study, Seralini and his team answered questions and concerns in a follow-up paper, and due to the increased public interest, the EFSA made some studies by Monsanto publicly available. But I checked, and meanwhile, these documents have been taken down again. Ah, well, there is another affair to cover, and it's called the Goodman Affair. So I briefly mentioned R.E. Goodman, who was involved in research on this antibiotic-resistant streptococcus. That's the guy we're talking about now. A few months after the study by Seralini was already published, the journal created a new position called Associate Editor for Biotechnology. And this position was given to that guy, Richard Goodman, formerly an employee of Monsanto. But the journal already had expertise in the area of GMOs. And this hiring choice was rather surprising because it was, I quote, bypassing the normal scientific editorial culture of gradual promotion from within. So it was quite peculiar that they suddenly hired Goodman. And while working for the journal, Goodman had also an ongoing involvement with an agency called ILSI. Don't they all sound the same? Well, but this specific agency is funded by large biotech companies and lobbies health authorities like the World Health Organization regarding GM regulation. So he was not completely independent. And as we have actually mentioned in the last episodes, this is again a perfect example of the revolving door describing the frequent job exchanges between lobbyists and federal officials. A few months after Goodman joined, Seralini's study was retracted. According to the editor-in-chief, I quote, "There is a legitimate cause for concern regarding both the numbers of animals in each study group and the particular strain selected." Well, definitely know that the second argument doesn't make sense. These Sprague Dawley rats were used by Monsanto in their study, and they are also recommended for chronic toxicology tests. So it's just weird that suddenly it's all about these rats being the wrong strain. Anyway, Seralini's study was open source republished in 2014 and is now freely available, so you can check it out if you like. Let's look at what we can learn from it, right? There is a larger issue within the food industry, which is about responsibility and work distribution. Monsanto, alongside many other chemical and food companies, hands over responsibility for safety to regulatory bodies like the FDA or the EFSA, right? The agencies that are supposed to check for food safety. But the regulatory agencies do not have the funding. They cannot approve and research all commercial products, and most of them do not have the budgets to double check and fund independent research. Therefore, they mostly rely on company-funded studies. Possibly due to the increased funding of private companies, the university budget for toxicology studies is declining. And as Seralini puts it himself, it's been quite a while since universities have stopped funding projects of any originality, including those destined to shed light on the toxicity of products already authorized by nations. Luckily, nowadays, foundations and group funding have taken their place. This highlights again how important it is to have independent funding as well. But even if that is present, it's not attractive as a researcher to study these, because one's reputation, mental health, and physical safety is on the line. And that's the same thing for media personalities. In our food history season, we talked in the episode 5.12 about the pink slime scandal, and that Oprah was sued for saying that she wants to eat less meat because mad cow's disease was going around. And you would think, who would sue Oprah? She was sued by the National Cattlemen's Association in the US, and she barely won. And even though she won, it cost her so much money. And it was a great sign to all other media personalities to be extremely, extremely worried about reporting on these topics. So let's summarize, huh? Monsanto had quite a few cases of products which were banned due to toxicity. And the two or three that we mentioned in this episode were really just a little snippet of that. When the Roundup patent ran out, Roundup-ready crops became essential to build Monsanto's position as a market leader. Most of the studies regarding GM crops and Roundup use were funded and are funded by the industry. They usually analyze glyphosate, so just the active ingredient instead of the entire formulation, and study Roundup-ready crops without analyzing Roundup residues. Before 2012, all studies were conducted too briefly, making it impossible to actually assess whether this is potentially carcinogenic. Seralini addressed these blind spots in his 2012 study, which was peer-reviewed by a Monsanto executive. The study is certainly not perfect, but we also need to consider that there was a very intricate PR and smear campaign, as proven by the Monsanto papers, so by internal company documents. There needs to be regulation set in place to avoid conflict of interest in peer reviews. And the publishing of the Monsanto papers was certainly a crucial step towards transparency. One big criticism for Seralini is that he himself was not 100% transparent in the way he communicated his research. He was giving journalists the access to the preprint, but forbidding them to consult external experts for whatever reason. If you have any points you would like to share with me, please reach out. I'm super happy to hear your feedback. You can reach me by typing in Marina Schmidt into LinkedIn or by looking up Red to Green on LinkedIn. I have certainly thought many times whether I should make an episode on this topic. If you want to support independent research in the field, consider donating to Red to Green on patreon.com/redtogreen. patreon.com/redtogreen. And if you don't feel like donating, well, the second best thing that you can do is sharing this episode in groups from your community, in working groups, in any place where you feel like people would be interested. Until next time, let's move the food industry from harmful to healthy, from polluting to sustainable, from red to green.